Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass may have in the middle of it. Grass may have in the middle. We are grass may have.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness, we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot going on this week. We've had James Comey testifying to Congress. But he had a Department of Justice attorney with him that didn't allow him to answer all the questions. We've had the burial of George H.W. Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. And there was not only a memorial in Washington, but there was also at St. Martin's Episcopal Church in Houston, there were services. And then the final burial ceremony was out at Texas A&M at the George H.W. Bush Memorial Library. So there's a lot going on, and we're going to be covering it, but there's one thing that came out this week. There were pre-sentencing reports, both on Manafort and Michael Cohen. And the Michael Cohen report is particularly troubling, I think, for the president. And I'm going to tell you why. There was a panel discussion recently on Fox, and These panel discussion members on there, they are some of the finest legal brains around. And the problem with him paying off, with President Trump having paid off those two women, is that now Michael Cohen is saying he was directed by the president and things like this, which gets him into really, really hot water, I believe. But anyway, listen to this a second and see what you think. Here we go right now.
Filings tonight that we've been digesting here live on air, but we have a panel now. Byron York, chief political correspondent of the Washington Examiner. Molly Hemingway, senior editor at The Federalist. David Kamnes, senior politics writer for U.S. News and World Report. We welcome back George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley. Okay, Byron, Molly, David, you've had time to read through. Byron, you first.
Well, I think with the case of Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort, you've always had to divide the actual personal crimes they committed in their own businesses versus the things that were related to Donald Trump. So taxing medallions, tax evasion, all of that stuff that Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to, and that's the stuff that's going to get him the real jail time, remember. You can kind of separate that. And likewise with Manafort, some of the Ukraine dealings, all of his shady businesses, buying a million suits and all of that stuff, you can separate that. So the question is, what new does this tell us about Trump? And as far as Michael Cohen is concerned, it doesn't tell us a lot more new, I think. The campaign contributions, the issue of paying off Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, and prosecutors characterizing that payoff
as at the direction of.
Yes, as the direction of the president, or at that time the candidate, characterizing that as an illegal contribution. That's could be troublesome for the president. I don't think there's a lot new on that. And also we heard that maybe Cohen had some contacts that we did not know about. As far as Manafort is concerned, you have more contacts with the administration. But most of what they're angry at Manafort about is he's still lying about his business in Ukraine. So I'm not sure that really changes the dynamic of the Trump-Russia scandal.
Molly?
I think the reason why this is important, too, is that we were sold the special counsel as an investigation into treasonous collusion with Russia to steal the election. And when you go through these, and I've done a cursory review, I would like to go through it again, we're not seeing treasonous collusion with Russia, nor anything close to it. And that's important because this is a wide-ranging special counsel that has found all sorts of things, gotten people to make plea agreements, or, you know, now we're at the sentencing stage for people. And this is something that even the people who set up this special special counsel are now admitting that it was set up not because they thought there was treasonous collusion with Russia to steal an election. We actually know from their own texts that at the time they set up the special counsel that they knew that there was not evidence of that, but in their words, to rein in the president and to constrain him. This is something, this is a very high price to pay for Donald Trump winning the election, and it's very important that people care about rule of law. Not that you can't find things that people have done that are crimes, but that there is an important issue here about the federal government, how it runs, and whether it's okay to win an election, even if it makes certain people very angry.
There is, as we referenced earlier, that part about Russia, David, in the special counsel filing, where he talks about how Cohen cooperated on the Russia-related matters. It seems to me sort of like coming attraction, not a...
Yeah, I mean, there's also a divide on how much Cohen cooperated. It seemed like the Southern District Court wants to send him away. Mueller seemed to say, oh, he's playing ball with us. Let's be a little more lenient. To me, the top line of this whole thing, all these documents, is one thing. It's that the Southern District Court of New York says the President of the United States engaged in a criminal conspiracy to violate campaign finance laws through those two payments. Forget the collusion. I don't think, well, this stack of papers does not prove the collusion, but just read it. Individual one is cited in this document two dozen times, and it says individual one directed a criminal conspiracy with his attorney to violate campaign finance, basically saying the President of the United States committed a felony.
That right, at the direction serious. Of, and that's the part that really captured everybody's attention, Molly.
And I know I might be disagreeing, which I never want to do, with Professor Turley here, but I think it's not an open and shut case. This is a very interesting section of the sentencing memo, and it is extremely overwritten. It is very dramatic. I don't think it's settled whether this would be a campaign election violation. And in order to make that case, you know, you should live your life in such a way that nobody ever tries to get you to pay money for silence. You should live your life that way, and I don't think that Donald Trump has lived his life that way. But in order to make this case, they basically are going to have to prove that Donald Trump has literally never paid anyone for their silence. That is something I might not be willing to
But in
to
the
risk.
Background, obviously, of all of that is the election that is ongoing. And you mentioned the writing there. Here it is. This is full screen memo number two. Cohen's commission of two campaign finance crimes on the eve of the 2016 election for President of the United States struck a blow to one of the core goals of the federal campaign finance laws, transparency. While many Americans who desired a particular outcome to the election knocked on doors, toiled at phone banks, or found any number of other legal ways to make their voices heard, Cohen sought to influence the election from the shadows. He did so by orchestrating secret and illegal payments to silence two women who otherwise would have made public their alleged extramarital affairs with individual one, Donald Trump. In the process, Cohen deceived the voting public by hiding alleged facts that he believed would have had a substantial effect on the election. It is this type of harm that Congress sought to prevent when it imposed limits on individual contributions to candidates. Jonathan.
Well, first of all, Molly's point is a good one. You still have to prove the crime. What's different here is that previously it was Michael Cohen that was alluding to Donald Trump's involvement. This is the special counsel saying it in a filing and saying that it views this account to be, quote, credible, if you look at both these filings together. That is serious. Now, it's not that the federal election crime itself is as serious. In some ways, obstruction is a type of parasitic crime. It lives off another crime. So if the special counsel is saying, look, there was this crime here on the federal election laws, and then there was an effort to obstruct efforts to reveal that crime, then the obstruction crime could become actually more serious than the original crime. That's the problem for the Trump administration, because courts will find that a very credible argument. Now, at the end of the day, I think there's still good arguments he could make that I was doing this as a husband. I was trying to basically silence people that I allegedly had affairs with. But when you have that obstruction allegation that is clearly being sort of laid out here, it gets more serious.
But, you know, that last line, Byron, where he's talking about Congress, it kind of serves up on a silver platter to House Democrats to determine whether that's high crimes and misdemeanor and start an impeachment process.
And that's what they're going to do.
The conclusion of this panel is they're setting him up because of his contributions, those payoffs to those two women that he had affairs with. They're setting him up on an obstruction type charge. And also a manipulation of the election also charged also, but with Michael Cohen being directed by the president. So you can see that the special, you know, Mueller, you know what I mean, prosecutor in this case, is very, very, very conniving. And he's reached out and dug down in there and gotten this the best he's gotten. There was no collusion with Russia by most of the people that looked at these memos and so forth, these pre-sentencing memos. But there's this election thing that Trump's going to have to try to get over in some way. And boy, I just don't know if he's going to be able to overcome that. Some of the points they made was that if he has a pattern of this, Trump has of paying off other people in the past because of certain problems like that, then they could use that in court. But here's the problem about this is that a sitting president can't be indicted while he's serving in the office of the presidency. But after he gets out, then he could be indicted at that time. But there are points that are being made by different discussion groups throughout the internet and on different talk shows. And what basically the bottom line is that if this were presented to a jury, then the jury would have to decide whether there was a pattern of past payoffs that would get him out of this payoff that he made shortly before the election. And that might be a jury might let him off on that. But the other decision a jury might reach is, yes, it would have affected, had it gotten out to the public, it would have affected the election. So anyway, that's what they're going back and forth on. But the danger here also is now that the House is being taken over by the Democrats, then they're going to take over and sit as head of all the chairmen of all the different committees in the House. That means the chairman has dictatorial power over subpoena, who they subpoena before those committees. And so this is going to be a real, real problem on dealing with this. And I just don't know how it's going to work out. But coming up next, that's right. Coming up next is Martha McCallum interviewing Matt Gaetz about the recent testimony of James Comey before a congressional committee. And he had an attorney from the Department of Justice with him that deferred him, that advised him not to answer certain questions because supposedly there were ongoing investigations on these questions that they couldn't reveal. So isn't that a clever way to hide behind that? But here we go with Martha McCallum and Matt Gaetz. These are really good people right here.
So the other big story today, former FBI Director James Comey grilled on the Hill for hours this afternoon by the House Judiciary Committee. Congressman Matt Gaetz was in the room, and he joins us next.
When you read the transcript, you will see that we're talking again about Hillary Clinton's emails, for heaven's sake, so I'm not sure we need to do this at all.
Highly anticipated. He was back to respond to more questions that the Republican Majority Committee had for him before the end of their term about Hillary Clinton's email investigation and other issues. But it seems that lawmakers weren't really satisfied with what they got today because they say they didn't get around to asking him a lot of things that they wanted to. So he's going to come back 10 days from now. He has agreed to that. Congressman Matt Gaetz is a member of the House Judiciary Committee and was in the room today. Congressman, thank you for being here tonight. Good to have you with us this evening. So what did he not want to answer today?
Well, the words that best describe Comey's testimony are selective amnesia. There was one part that I thought was particularly interesting. It describes his actions directly following his conversation with President Trump, where he believes the president may have obstructed justice by referencing the Michael Flynn investigation. As soon as Comey's done with the president, he prepares a memo and then meets with his senior team at the FBI. He couldn't tell us who was in the room, who was out of the room, and while he shared that the consensus was that they would not tell Jeff sessions. They would not tell Rod Rosenstein. They would simply keep the information themselves. He would not share what McCabe's views were. What were the views of Bill Priestep or other people that may have been present? And I think that that creates a problem for us because we want to get a sense of what people's viewpoint was during this particular critical moment in time.
So that if the statement that the president said was so egregious, you feel that he should have shared it with more people and that perhaps it wasn't shared in a way that made it appear to be a big deal at that time? Is that what
you're
saying?
Well, yeah, so in this sense, Martha, if the President of the United States committed a crime in Jim Comey's presence, it's bizarre that Comey never told anyone above him in the chain of command. And Sessions had not recused himself at this point in time. Comey used a phrase in the hearing today. He called Sessions on the cusp of recusal. And that was Comey's basis for not telling Sessions what had happened. But when you only are speaking to your subordinates, it's a different thing than elevating something that you would think would be ripe enough for a critical decision.
Yeah, I can't help but think, this is sort of an aside, but that there is some irony in the fact that James Comey says that the president asked him to go easy on Mike Flynn, right? And now what we've learned this week is that Robert Mueller has asked the judge to go kind of easy on Mike Flynn. Which just makes you wonder if maybe what Mike Flynn did wasn't as bad as anybody thought, and maybe that was the president's intention, if indeed he did say that, and it appears to be the feeling of Robert Mueller, which is also based on the cooperation, of course.
Yeah, and the point you make highlights the bizarre nature of a lot of these process-based prosecutions. If I were President Trump, I'd pardon Paul Manafort, I would commute the sentence of Michael Flynn, and be done with those two, because the only reason those people were prosecuted is because of politics, not because of their crimes. Look, if Manafort was going to be prosecuted as a consequence of his tax crimes or lobbying crimes, that would have happened like more than a decade ago, and you know who was in the decision tree for that? Rod Rosenstein, when he wasn't initially prosecuted. And so Manafort today faces consequence, not a result of what he did, but as a result of his service in the Trump campaign. And that's precisely why we ought to have the pardon power, so that you don't have overzealous prosecutors going after people because of their politics. President should pardon him right away, take it off the table. Cohen, very different story. I mean, Michael Cohen is being called to account for his present day improper conduct, the things that he's done. And I think in that circumstance, the Southern District of New York may be right that he ought to get a long prison sentence.
We'll see. Just back to Comey for a moment here. He said when he came out of the room and he spoke with reporters, the suggestion that the FISA process was abused is nonsense.
Well, he wouldn't answer a lot of questions about the FISA process, but I think it's notable that in the information presented to the FISA court, there was not an accurate description of who paid for what. This is another area where Comey's testimony today contradicted his own lawyer. Jim Baker talked about how uncomfortable and weird it was that he had come into possession of the dossier and was part of the chain of custody for that dossier. That's not something that general counsels of the FBI typically do. Today, Comey told us that he never knew that the Perkins Coie law firm was involved in taking money from the DNC and then using that money to pay Christopher Steele to say things and develop a story about the president. And so, like, that's pretty inconceivable to me that the general counsel of the FBI is uncomfortable coming into the chain of custody of evidence that had never happened before, and the director of the FBI somehow knows nothing about it.
Yep,
another
that's
case of selective amnesia.
That is very interesting. You know, the other thing is, the leak of Michael Flynn's name, which, you know, potentially is a crime, obviously, of leaking classified information that was picked up on an intercept between, on a conversation between the National Security Advisor and, the incoming National Security Advisor and the ambassador to Russia. Did anyone ask him, did you get a chance to ask him whether or not there was any investigation into that and whether or not, you know, what he knows about Sally Yates' potential role in all of that, because she had her hair on fire about Michael Flynn early on.
Yeah, we should have asked more questions, but really a lot of the activity post May 9, Comey did not have information on because he had been terminated. We did ask about Sally Yates, but that was largely in the context of why in the world Comey and the FBI and the Department of Justice allowed people who were associated with Hillary Clinton's criminal conduct to then, you know, be around her and to participate in some of the interviews that were occurring at that time.
What did he say about that? You know, in terms of why Cheryl Mills was given immunity and why he wrote up his document of exoneration before he had even interviewed Hillary Clinton.
Comey's answer was, well, you know, the other people associated with Hillary, we sort of decided they probably weren't criminals, and so, gee, it was unusual, but we didn't think it would hurt the case too much. When you have institutions like the FBI and Department of Justice depart from their normal practices to do these one-off deals for people in politics or celebrity figures, it erodes our confidence that justice is blind and that it's equal for everyone. And I think that you don't have to just take congressional Republicans' word for it. Even the Democrat Inspector General Michael Horowitz said that Comey had a problem where he would regularly exceed the role of the FBI director. He would break the chain of command and he would simply take it upon himself to make all the major decisions. We saw that James Comey ego on full display today.
We're seeing such wrongdoing at such high levels, both in the FBI and Department of Justice in the past under Barack Obama. And under his last two administrations, you could say his 8 years, there was all kinds of scandals. He had kids down there in retention, just like President Trump did within those restraining type of cages. You could say not cages, but they're like cyclone fence types of enclosures. But it's to keep the child from being molested by other people there possibly also. So, you know, Barack Obama had the same thing. He did the same thing. He talked tough line on immigration also when he was president. But now, because Trump is talking a tough line, then they're going over and saying that he's heartless and he's mean and mean-spirited and he doesn't care about people and things like that. So anyway, that's what we're continually running up with. And the media, are you kidding me? I mean, well, we don't have a media. We have a propaganda machine out here, what has evolved into. And these people don't do anybody any good. They just go on and on and on with propaganda and criticism of Trump. Trump opens himself up at times because he pops off too much. He just sticks his foot in his mouth sometimes. So they're just waiting for those. They wait there when he gets on the helicopter or when he's getting off the helicopter at these times where they can keep him, catch him off guard, and then they ask him these questions, then he comes back with a sound bite here or there, and he's not thinking sometimes about what he's saying. But anyway, he's done a lot of good things, and now it looks like that this economy, if this economy turns down, and then they proceed with an impeachment proceedings, it could be bad. And the way I see this thing unfolding on the impeachment possibilities, now that the House is controlled by the Democrats, then it only takes a simple majority to actually bring impeachment charges. Those charges go over to the Senate, and there's actually a trial held there where the Chief Justice will be sitting there as the judge in this trial of the president. But they have to affect for conviction of this impeachment. They have to have 2/3 of the senators vote in favor of impeachment of a conviction. Now, in this case, this is one of the very few cases where you think, well, majority, you know, of senators or Republicans, they'll never get that. This is an exceptional, unique case where both parties are against President Trump, and they might just be able to get that 2/3 vote. This is what I fear could happen now that the House, you know, is controlled by the Democrats, and they will bring impeachment, you know, charges, then those charges will actually start the trial. But the trial, I think, could be a conviction because they're all against him. That's sort of what I'm looking at right now. Now, coming up next is John Solomon, interviewed by Sean Hannity. And there's been some recent investigation and research done by John Solomon on a chain of emails that ties all of these people into much of this wrongdoing. And they'll be discussing that. But also, just recently, there was 6,000 pages of literature and documents about the Clinton Foundation. So this thing is really, really beginning to catch fire. And Hillary's in big trouble. Now, she still has all of these friends in government, you know, here and there and so forth. So how far this is going to go, I don't know. It might be come out to a Mexican standoff where they say to Trump, we won't, you know, impeach if you don't go any further on these investigations. So that's the way politics works sometimes, but we'll just have to wait and see. But coming up next is John Solomon and Sean Hannity. And boy, it's a very, very insightful interview. Here we go.
All right, joining us now on more breaking news, on top of his report yesterday about the Clinton Foundation, is The Hill's John Solomon. This article means to me that if all that evidence, 6,000 pages, is that total?
That's right, 6,000 pages, 95 exhibits.
95 exhibits. Okay, so now the question is, why don't we go through what they found and why we are here and why they have not been under more fire?
Yeah, I think first of all, it's interesting who they are, who made this complaint. These are former experts for the Drug Enforcement Agency, for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Connecticut, for major compliance, for major Wall Street firms. These are people that live and breathe tax law and good governance, and they put together this complaint. They assembled a lot of internal documents from the Clinton Foundation. Perhaps most importantly, two legal reviews that the Clinton Foundation did on itself. And what they found is that the Clinton Foundation itself, its own lawyers, warned that there was a strong possibility that donors were being made promises of quid pro quo favors from Secretary Clinton when she was in the Obama administration in return for gifts to the foundation. They warned that there was a culture of noncompliance, not wanting to comply with the law, with the rules that the foundation had to follow. They said that Bill Clinton's personal interest and his commingling of his personal business with the foundation posed a grave threat to the foundation itself. These are not Republicans. These are not partisans saying it. These are internal documents of lawyers hired by the Clinton Foundation to find out what was going on wrong in the foundation. This is what they found. So these investigators assemble all this evidence. They then go and they interview the current CFO, the longtime CFO of the Clinton Foundation, a guy named Andy Kessel. And they do this in November 16, and they take him out to dinner or lunch in New York. And they begin asking, hey, are there problems here? And according to their memo, their interview memo after they met with him, Kessel makes several spontaneous claims that he can't control Bill Clinton, that people have been trying to stop him from commingling personal business with the foundation, but nobody can control him. And he makes the most provocative of statements, allegedly, if you believe this memo, in which he says, I know where all the bodies are buried at the Clinton Foundation. So they assemble all this evidence. They give it to the IRS in August 16. They give it to the main Justice Department of Donald Trump's Justice Department in October 2017. And then in early 2018, they're called by the FBI in Little Rock, and they provide the evidence to the FBI in Little Rock, which means the main apparatus, the IRS and the FBI and the Justice Department, now have access to all of these allegations of wrongdoing.
What is happening? I mean, look, John, you're talking about 6,000 pages, 95 exhibits, a 48-page submission. And the evidence, as I read in your article, seems overwhelming and incontrovertible here. How has it been sitting for a year, especially in light of we already know the issue of Hillary's violation of the Espionage Act by having that mom-and-pop shop server? We had secret, top secret, classified information on it. That's a violation of the Espionage Act, obstructing justice as it relates to how she deleted emails, washed her hard drive clean, and had devices broken up. They seem to skate every time. You're describing literally systematic violations of every charitable contribution law imaginable here, including IRS violations. They're sitting on that for a year? Who's looking into it?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. I think we're going to get a very important answer. I want to put a special date on your calendar. Next Thursday, Chairman Mark Meadows, a House subcommittee on the House Oversight Committee, is going to have a hearing. These two of the whistleblowers who helped form this complaint and did all this investigative work are going to testify for the first time in public. And they've asked the Justice Department to come in and say, what have you done with this? Mr. Huber, John Huber, the special U.S. attorney who President Clinton's former attorney general, Jeff Sessions, named a year ago. What have you done? How much money have you spent? Bob Mueller spent tens of millions of dollars. What have you done to look at these allegations? And we may get our first answer in public to what the Justice Department has done. Now, we have some hints in my story. We know that the FBI not only had contact with these whistleblowers, but I am able to confirm from Clinton Foundation sources that Kessel, the CFO, the guy who ran the finances, was interviewed by the FBI in 2017. We know that Doug Campbell, the undercover informant that was undercover in the Russian nuclear, he was interviewed by the same Little Rock FBI. Yeah, Uranium One informant. So we do see some activity, and if I had to guess from my reporting, if there is action going on, it's centered in Little Rock, Arkansas. But for the first time, Congress is going to put the Trump Justice Department's own officials, their feet to the fire, and we're going to get an answer. Have you done anything? How much have you spent on this? Is there illegality, or should we drop this line of inquiry with the Clinton Foundation? Next Thursday could be the day we get our answer.
The people that you've spoken to on the legal side, do they see laws violated?
They do. And so I sent this to a half dozen former FBI, IRS experts who focused in charity fraud and financial fraud. And all of them said to a T, if this walked into my door, it would give me a predicate for opening a criminal investigation of the Clinton Foundation and perhaps individuals inside of it. Every one of them said that. I think one of them, Jeff Tanick, very well-known, decorated FBI agent, made some of the most complex financial fraud cases in the history of the Bureau, said, I would open up on this in a second based on what these good investigators put together in this private document.
Back-to-back huge bombshells by John Solomon. We're going to have you back tomorrow and the rest of the week into next week to get into this more deeply. John, thank you. All right, joining us with more reaction, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes is with us. First, do you have any reaction to what you just heard from John Solomon? And then I want to go to his big breaking report from yesterday.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me, Sean. I mean, we have actively been looking into the Clinton Foundation, Uranium One, if you may remember that. We assigned a task force leader, Peter King from New York, to look into this. So we have seen some troubling information on this, and I can't verify John's reporting. He always does a good job. He has great sources, and I'm sure there's much more to be learned on it.
Let me go back to his breaking news yesterday. What we discovered, apparently, and I don't know how this was not known when we go back 2 years now, pretty much investigating this whole issue, the Clinton bought and paid for phony dossier, et cetera. What we now have found out, there is an email chain or a chain of emails. James Comey is on it. Top DOJ officials are on it. And they knew, and the Intel community had massive questions about the veracity, the truthfulness, the validity of the dossier, which your memo and the Grassley-Graham memo point to as the bulk of the applications for the FISA warrant against Carter Page. When did you first find out about this email chain?
Well, I don't know that the email chain and John's reporting is the same stuff that we're looking at, although it sounds very similar. What we have been saying, and this is when as high as the Speaker of the House, we have been requesting for many months now, and I actually talked about it on your show a couple weeks ago, that there are emails where there are redactions that we are quite convinced that if that is unredacted and provided to the House of Representatives, to the Intelligence Committee, it will be very clear that there is very much, it was very well known that there was a lot of information that was not provided to the FISA court leading up to the warrant on Carter Page. So I don't know exactly who John's sources are, but I do know that we have been trying to get these redactions from emails without looking. It's possible that we are talking about the same types of emails. It's also possible, Sean, that there's even more emails that we don't even know about. But what we are aware of, what I call the fourth bucket of information, it would be very clear that there were people within the FBI and DOJ that knew well and good before they went to the FISA court that Christopher Steele and others were up to some bad and nefarious activity.
You're saying that these emails would be the fourth bucket. The 302s would be a second bucket. The FISA application themselves, especially the last one, pages 10 through 12, 17 to 34, then the Gang of Eight information. Those would be the four buckets. What John is saying here.
That's correct. And those first three, remember, Sean, in those first three, the president has actually called to have declassified.
But he's holding it back,
he now recently
said.
Is this fourth bucket.
Okay, so what I want to ask you is, if they knew, and if the Intelligence Committee knew that they were questionable, that the whole dossier was questionable, and it was the bulk of the FISA applications, and they used it anyway. We know that they omitted that Hillary bought and paid for it with a footnote that said it might have a political taint to it, but they didn't say it was the opposition party candidate. Is it possible that they knew it was not true, that they gave it to the FISA court anyway, that they didn't do their due diligence, verify and corroborate it, and that they totally and completely committed fraud on the FISA court, not once, but four separate times, meaning anybody that signed off on it was signing off on an application to spy on an American with evidence that they at best thought could very likely not be true.
Yeah, so remember what we've been looking at criminally has been abuse of power, whether or not there was a conspiracy to abuse power. You know about that. You've talked about that for a long time. What this gets into is this would be the first clear evidence that we have on another major crime, which would be called lying to a federal judge, which is a crime and a major crime. So that is
but
really
that would mean,
at the heart
but the
of
people
this.
We're talking about
if
would
these
be
do
Comey.
Exist, it is the evidence that
this,
we have.
This would be Comey signing off on it. Rod Rosenstein signing off on the last one.
Well,
that would be Sally Yates signing off on it, right?
Well, they're the ones that signed off on it, but they're not necessarily the ones who would have provided and doctored the information. So really the people that are culpable here are the ones who were in these discussions that knew about the information that was not provided to the court.
Even though Adam Schiff, who I have a lot of issues with, will be the chairman of the committee come January, will you still have the authority and the ability to get this information to the American people?
Yeah, I mean, the only difference is that I will be the Republican leader on the committee. The question is that the subpoena power will lay in the hands of the Democrats.
But the Senate would have the power, too, as well.
Like I said, that's true, but we have also, for many months here, Sean, been willing to, we've said that, look, our investigation's over with. The White House is going to be able to declassify a lot of this information to help us out to get to the bottom of this.
All right. Congressman Nunes, you've done great work. So has John Solomon. If so, that basically what I said is true. That is, there is no equal justice, equal application of our laws. That would be shredding, literally shredding, if you're giving false information to a court to obtain a FISA warrant to spy on an American and not even verifying it. Wow.
What I forgot to add was that Devin Nunes was at the end of this Sean Hannity interview with John Solomon. And what he's basically saying is that the committees in the House now will go over to control by the Democrats with their chairmanship. And so they have the power to subpoena. But Devin Nunes is saying basically at the end of this interview that with that said and done, they still, you know, have some power on the committees, the Republicans will. But now it's up to the president to declassify the FISA, you know, reports and all that other things that are not have not been fully declassified yet. And then it'll blow the lid off about everything. And that's basically what Devin Nunes said. And I think that's the way to go. I mean, why not? You know, what is there to lose now? And you've just got to go for that and just go for it. I mean, there's no two ways about it, you know. And so, you know, what do we do with scoundrels and scallywags and criminals that have gotten into very, very powerful positions? And in these powerful positions, there's all kinds of money thievery, I'm sure, plundering of our treasury and so forth. But we just, yeah, my gosh, it gets crazy. Now coming up next is Tom Fitton, okay? And in his interview, he talks about some very, very important things that are revelations, I should say, that have recently come up about the emails. He also makes some comments on these recently released pretrial, you could say, sentence reports. But anyway, let's listen to what Tom Fitton has to say during this interview. Here we go now, Tom Fitton.
Well, as we said at the open, there is breaking news from the Mueller investigation. We're not exactly sure what some of it means, but it is coming at us right now. Former FBI Director Jim Comey testified, by the way, on Capitol Hill today. He dropped his initial plans to mount a legal challenge to the subpoena he received from Republicans on the committee. What did we learn from Comey on the Hill? Tom Fitton was watching carefully. He is president of Judicial Watch, here to tell us about that and to assess the Mueller memos we were just talking about. But first to Comey, Tom, thanks for coming on. What do we learn?
Well, we learned that Comey isn't worried about being prosecuted for any misconduct because he didn't take the Fifth. And we also learned the FBI and Justice Department are still hampering the investigation by ordering him not to answer many key questions, according to Republicans who've complained about the way it proceeded. we're going to have.
Can I ask you a question, though? Didn't Comey, am I overstating this, and I want to be fair, but it seemed to me like Comey committed perjury last time he testified because he said that he had never participated in leaking while FBI director, and then Andy McCabe, who would know, later said that he had. Did anyone ask him about that?
Well, I don't know, but I guess it depends on what the meaning of leak is.
I guess it does.
And he took those FBI memos, FBI files of Donald Trump, and leaked them with the specific purpose of getting a special counsel appointed. You know, he ought to be under criminal investigation for taking those records and leaking them. And he's also under investigation about potentially taking classified information. And, you know, if you're under criminal investigation at the federal level, and someone asks you questions about it in an official circumstance like this, you often take the fifth.
Are you starting to? Meanwhile,
but
George,
he didn't.
George Papadopoulos was in prison until a minute ago. Are you getting the impression that the truly powerful really don't face legal consequences? It's always the little guy. It's always Jerome Corsi, some 72-year-old writer for Newsmax, who gets threatened with prison. But Jim Comey, the FBI director, gets to do whatever he wants. That kind of seems like the lesson.
Well, it's not necessarily powerful, but it's a partisan process. Because President Trump's powerful, but he's being attacked and abused.
Good point.
But if you're connected to the Democratic establishment, if there's a partisan nature here, which is to get Trump, you're protected. And Mr. Comey is Mueller's witness. He appointed Mueller. He's friends with Mueller. He worked with Mueller. He's friends with Mueller. And now we're seeing what happens if you're one of a friend of Mueller. You get protected by this Justice Department and this FBI. And if you're not a friend of Mueller, you'll be used and abused in the case of Cohen, who was used to go after Trump in dishonest ways, in my view, by this special counsel. And he's being abused and being thrown under the bus. Oh, yeah, we used his testimony. We were able to insert the word Russia 50 million times as a result of these plea deals that really didn't have anything to do with Russia collusion. But we're going to ask the court to allow him to go to jail for at least 3.5 years.
It's making a lot of us very cynical, and I wish it weren't, because I love this country. There was a ruling today pertaining to Judicial Watch and Hillary's emails. What happened?
Well, actually, it was yesterday. It was a big ruling by Judge Royce Lamberth, who opened up discovery into the Clinton email issue. He's angry about what the Justice Department and the FBI did. He fears that he was hoodwinked, or they tried to hoodwink Judicial Watch and the court in keeping these emails away from us. He's concerned that Hillary Clinton created this email system to avoid FOIA. And he really went after this Justice Department for coming into court and engaging in what he called chicanery to try to make excuses for and explain away the misconduct that saw these emails hidden and the email system used to avoid court scrutiny, congressional scrutiny, and questions from the American people. In fact, he asked, was Benghazi one of the reasons they didn't want us to know about these emails? So this discovery is significant.
Amazing.
And, you know, Congress is out to lunch on this, and Justice Department is on the other side, but the court wants more answers.
Whatever happens to the Republican Congress, we got to do a series on that, maybe in January. Tom, great.
You're welcome,
to see
Tucker.
You. Thank you.
Now, what Tucker brought out from Tom Fitton is head of Judicial Watch, and they do a lot of discovery and filing of lawsuits under Freedom of Information Acts and so forth, and they get a lot of good information. And what he finally his decision recently from a federal judge is that the emails were hidden by the Justice Department on probably Hillary's for her to cover her, you know. And so this judge said, we're going to give Judicial Watch discovery power and to negotiate it through discovery process and so forth. And answering certain questions that are the judge posed to the other side. So Tom Fitton and them are in good shape on this. And boy, they've done a really, really stand up job. We've got an ongoing problem now in Paris, and it's called the Yellow Vest, you could say, protest movement. And what's happened over there is that the federal government went up appreciably on gas taxes, on gasoline fuel for their cars. And many of the Parisians and many of the other Frenchmen are having a hard time making a living over there. And so as a result, they're protesting in the streets and they're wearing those yellow. According to French law, everyone that has a car is supposed to have a yellow vest in their car in case of emergency and they have to get out of the car on the side of the road. they can be seen by other motorists, so they're not hit or, you know, accident by accidents and so forth, to minimize accidents. But I did some study a number of years ago on the French economy itself, and I found that they were moving, the corporate structure over there was moving towards short-term employment versus full-time employment. And the reason was is there was an example that I gave in that program back then of a French worker, a full-time French worker making $7,000. And then after you take out all of these taxes and withholdings and this and that, all these supposedly free things that they're supposed to get, he only took home, the average worker that made $7,000 a month would only take home $1,900, of which even part of that had to be paid for federal taxes. So additional taxes. So the French people are being squeezed by a higher and higher cost of living. And that's really what's behind this. Macron, the president of France, has come up with this tax as a means by which to nullify and to reduce somewhat emissions because of this global warming thing that's right around the corner. And so the French people said, well, we don't believe in that. We want to live and we want lower, you know, cost of living, and to heck with all of this global warming. So the protest is about that, and also about the influx of immigrants, of Muslim immigrants into the country that are causing quite an uproar among the French people. So those two things together are causing a lot of problem for the French. And today I was watching Ruply, R-U-P-T-L-Y, is a on YouTube. You can go in there and say, you know, live video Ruply. Ruply is a, you could say, an agent of the Russians. They have a service. They go in and do live streaming from certain events and rallies and very activist, you know, protest movements that they do a lot of. And they don't do any commentary. They just do a video of it, and then they uplink it to a satellite, and then it's all over. You know, then they can put it on YouTube and everything else. So they were doing some very, very insightful video today, along with other broadcasters there in Paris, the Champs de Lausanne. And it was interesting to see the yellow shirts being corralled around, and also with tear gas. They were firing a lot of tear gas and a lot of setting off a lot of loud explosions and stuff like that to frighten the crowd itself. But that's ongoing in France, and they haven't resolved that yet. Macron is going down on the tax. He says, no, we're going to do away with it now, but it's getting late in the game, and they want more. They want him to resign and so forth. So that's ongoing right now. You could say John Kelly, he's the chief guy there in the White House, chief of staff. He's going to be leaving the White House soon, and that's just come out recently. And today, before Trump got on his helicopter to go to Andrews, you know, he said that to some of the press and so forth. We have Ocasio-Cortez is threatening Trump Jr., and now they may file an ethics charge on her as she goes into Congress this next. So this newly elected Ocasio-Cortez there from New York area, Bronx, may have an ethics charge on her now of threatening Trump Jr. with a subpoena power. She was, you know, so I think she was triggered by some meme, you know, that Trump Jr. put out. So, you know, she's really a newcomer, and she has no clue about what it costs to run the government. So she's not going to work up there. She's way to the left. They're already calling her a socialist, and she might be more further to the left than that even. So it's not going to work for her up there. And it's actually giving the Democratic Party a bad name. And it's trying to, it looks like that she and other very leftist, extreme leftists are trying to corral the party to their way of thinking, which would be either socialist, communist, left. And they're being used by the real big money out there. And so it's just not going to work. And also Michael Cohen was paid $4 million by people that wanted access to Trump. So he was hustling. Michael Cohen was hustling. This is coming out through all this investigations and all this federal problem that he got into. And then he turns against Trump, who could provide him with a pardon. And then now Trump's down on him. And he says that they ought to just give him the maximum sentence. So Michael Cohen made some very, very, very bad decisions about who he should have affiliated himself with, who he should have been loyal to. He was a personal attorney for Trump for years in New York City, and he should have been loyal to Trump and not treated him that way, and probably would have avoided all of these legal problems with a pardon of some kind or a computation of a sentence or something like that. That's basically what is going on, you know. Now, just switching back to Paris, they were using tear gas. They made mass arrests over there. There were looters raiding the shops. There was a rush on the presidential palace. And Macron remains invisible. He's not be seen. There are clashes in Belgium with these yellow vest people there now. And one of the articles came out is it said, is America next? You know, the Arc de Triomphe is in the background and shows these yellow vest people burning stuff in the streets, you know. And one of the articles said, is America next? You know, I hope not. And anyway, we have a launch recently. Okay, a space launch, okay? And what happened to the booster, the main booster? It didn't return. SpaceX made this launch. And they made some beautiful launches where they would shoot the rocket off and then the booster, the main booster, would be coming back and land right back on the pad that it had departed from. I mean, they've done some very, very miraculous, beautiful engineering and rocket things, there are missile things, but this time it landed out. I think there was a problem with the main booster. It landed out in the water, and they said they did recover it. See, you know, we've got problems over here with Tommy Robinson. You know, Nigel Farage is quitting the party, the UKIP party over there, and he's saying, well, because Tommy Robinson is becoming affiliated with the UKIP, then he's not going to be in that party anymore. And Tommy Robinson's a stand-up guy. And I think in the past, it could have been his affiliation with an ultra-right, you know, movement and group over there that sort of besmirched him for a while. But what I've heard from him lately, to my way of thinking, he's okay. And he's becoming a leader over there of the right, you know. And he's against Brexit and all that, you know. Well, I mean, he's for breaking away. He's for Brexit, you know, for exiting, the European Union. And so he's a nationalist. But what we're seeing now out here in Europe and in places like Hungary and other places is that this word nationalist has been turned into, it's been Nazified, you know, by your ultra leftist. And your statist and people like that. And they've tried to make it a bad word. And then they started associating it with Trump and other people that believe in the nation state of their countries that they're part of, see, or they're leaders of. And so they're trying to knock out the nation state and then consolidate all of these different formerly nation states into a world system, a new world order, see. I think President Bush, 41, talked about the New World Order several times during his administration when he was president. And they did bury him just recently down at A&M at College Station. George H.W. Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, has a library there at College Station. There's two cities. There's Bryan, Texas. And then there's College Station. Well, Texas A&M is right there at College Station. So these two little bedroom cities have grown up together. Now you can't tell the difference when you drive from one into the other. But the Aggies have always been very, very loyal and very militaristic. And the cadets down there, boy, there's no one better in military and has given their lives for this country than your Aggies. I mean, they have a long line history of doing great for this country. And so as a result, I think George Herbert Walker Bush put his library down there. And they did also extend the runway there. There's a runway there at College Station now. And I think that at 747 can land there. In fact, I was watching today President Trump's 747 Air Force One takeoff from Andrews. And Andrews has one runway 9,000 feet, almost 10,000, and another one over 11,000 feet long that are parallel to one another. And either one of those, I think you need 10,000 feet to be safe in taking off and landing a 747. I believe that's basically the minimum that they hope to have. I think they can take it off in less than that, but if there's a problem and they have to shut down suddenly, they'd be off the end of the runway if it was a shorter runway than that. So we're coming up. There have been recent releases of under MK Ultra, okay, Mind Wash Ultra, that were back in the 60s. There's just been releases just recently of what the CIA was carrying out back in the 60s, and that was quite a few experiments. They had psychotronic experiments and drug experiments with LSD, and they would give LSD to someone and then watch what they did, but the person was unaware they had been giving anything. So they did some real dastardly things like that in it, and now it's coming out again. This has been revealed before, but this is officially coming out now. So that also we had the Wall Street pull back appreciably. And I always thought with my circle of friends, I told my friends that President Trump was making a mistake by associating himself with a thriving up, you know, growing, thriving, expanding Wall Street, especially the Dow on the upside. Because I said someday that thing's going to come down, and then the public will tag Trump with bringing it down. See, there's no way to win with the stock markets. You have to just look at those objectively, but you don't say that what you're doing is making the market move up on the upside, because those are market dynamics of buying and selling, and there's a lot of different variables in that. It's international, see. The money moves in, the money moves out, see. And interest rates are very important. I had a speech today with a friend of mine that's in the oil and gas industry, and he's saying that West Texas Intermediate, they have highways out there that are full. They can't get enough product out of West Texas. And so West Texas Intermediate has just getting it out, just trucking it out of there has become somewhat of a problem, say. But he said other fields like down on the coast there, along the coast, there are some other oil fields and they're doing real well. And we are producing a tremendously large amount of oil, of crude oil and so forth. We've become a net exporter over the last few years. And I think President Trump's idea of keeping that going, I think that we need a source of cheap, you know, fuel for energy that we can start competing on world markets because of our energy cost again. And I think that makes sense. I just hope and pray that Trump can make it through this thing. And I'm really worried now with the Democrats controlling the House, but we've still got the Department of Justice under hopefully a new, Attorney General. Maybe William Barr might be the one. I just hope he works out. But he is an establishment man, so I just hope and pray that will work. I want to thank everybody out there for listening tonight. We certainly appreciate each and every one of you. And all life is precious, and especially the little people. Their lives are especially precious. So good night. Bye-bye.